Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor of News on WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, John.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Joshua Balling's calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with a look at the news. And protesters had their day in court, or their days in court this week, and they're there because they were arrested, apparently, for allegedly trespassing at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station.
This was a group of from the Downwinders, a group that has been actively trying to, they say, bring out what they see are or raise awareness, what they see are the safety issues and problems with the evacuation plan surrounding the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. And they did, I think it's no question they're not denying that they trespassed last spring on two occasions at the plant. They were been charged with trespassing, and they've been charged in the past with trespassing, but the charges were always dropped. They really wanted to go to trial because they wanted to increase the awareness that among the public, that's their motive, about issues. And they've been calling witnesses that, quote-unquote, expert witnesses. Well, I shouldn't say quote-unquote. They're recognized expert witnesses to the trial this week, including Richard Clapp, who was a epidemiologist and retired BU professor from the School of Public Health. He was actually started the State Cancer Registry back in 1980 and was the head of it. And he testified that there are elevated cancer rates, especially leukemia, among workers from the plant and people living around the plant. They had another expert talk about the number of spent fuel rods in the spent fuel rod pool, saying that there are more rods at Pilgrim than there were at Fukushima, the plant that essentially had several meltdowns in their fuel, at least one fuel pool after the tsunami. He's saying there's 3,800 rods as opposed, and the pool was designed for 580 or so. And so today they are going to have somebody talking about social change and a professor, and from Dan Wolf as well, senator from Harwich, who has been outspoken against the nuclear power plant.
And it's really interesting the judge is allowing them to bring these witnesses and have this discussion. We heard, at least reported in the paper, the spokesperson for the plant saying, look, this isn't a trial about the merits of the plant or the safety issues of the plant. This is about people who trespassed where they weren't supposed to be. But the judge seems to be indulging this.
Right. And the Cape Codders have what's called a necessary defense. And that under that legal determination or legal standard, they have to demonstrate that they broke the law in order to get their intended result. Their intended result is to make people aware of what they see are problems at the nuclear power plant that may be, what they say, are dangerous to the public. The evacuation plan, for example, everybody in Plymouth is going to have to be evacuated first if there's some kind of emergency at the plant before Cape Codders can even start heading off Cape. They're saying that that's an issue. It's a flaw in, and it's a safety issue for Cape Codders.
So they're saying they have no alternative but to address this in some way, and this is how they chose to do it.
With civil disobedience.
Civil disobedience.
And in the meantime, I just want to add really quickly, last week, they went up to the governor's office and were kind of protesting outside his office, and they were able to get him to say that he would send a letter to the NRC asking them to shut the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station because of safety issues, and he did that this week, basically saying if the station cannot comply with all health and safety and environmental regulations, it should be shuttered. He also talked about the problems with the evacuation plan. The plant spokesman said, well, that's what the NRC does all the time. They don't allow plants to operate if they're not if they're breaking health, safety, and environmental regulations.
Right, and the governor has no real authority here. It really is a federal jurisdiction issue, though some have said he could do more in terms of the evacuation and mandating that MEMA, the state's emergency management agency, actually be required to do more regarding a plan to get off Cape if something happened at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. President Obama and his family will be returning to Martha's Vineyard this summer. Let the fun begin for the journalists.
Right.
and for people living on Martha's Vineyard.
Well, this year he's coming from August 9th to the 23rd, which is longer than last time. Last year he was here for 9 days. And for a good portion of that, his daughters weren't with him. Mm-hmm. Was the big story back, one of the big stories. He played a lot of golf every day. But they're coming back. Last year they stayed in a house that was near the South Road, and they had to, which is a main thoroughfare on the vineyard, that caused some issues because they had the property was close to the road, so they had to close it, and it caused closed sections of it caused problems for businesses and traffic. So it looks like they're not going to be staying there, but they are going to be heading back to the Cape, and I'm sure if the past is any indication, there's going to be a lot of golf and maybe Nancy's restaurant and a bunch of grapes will be on the itinerary as well.
And of course, President Clinton had come before President Obama. It's becoming a popular place for presidential vacations, that's for sure. We're going to be talking to Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times a little later in the show, and perhaps he'll have some perspective on whether people living on the vineyard are getting used to this and are coming maybe to enjoy it a bit. I'm not sure. We'll have to ask. A federal opinion came out this week from the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the Department of the Interior backing the Mashpee Wampanoag's claims that they actually were under federal jurisdiction early in the nation's history.
Well, the opinion that came out looks like it backs the Wampanoag petition to have land put into trust. They haven't made a decision quite yet, mm-hmm. but the significance of this legal opinion that was announced by Federal Solicitor Hillary Tompkins at the National Conference of Native American Indians lays the groundwork for what under federal jurisdiction means in terms of whether a tribe was under federal jurisdiction or not. And when the Bureau of Indian Affairs is making its decision. I think it's the Department of Interior is making its decision on whether a tribe can have land put into trust. In the Wampanoag case, they need the land put into trust in Taunton so that they can build their Indian casino. And there was a ruling in 2009 by the Supreme Court that upheld the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, which stated that any tribe recognized after 1934 was then ineligible to have land put into trust. But the ruling also left the door open for tribes that had been under federal jurisdiction. And the Wampanoags filed a petition with the Department of Interior saying we were under federal recognition. Although we were not federally recognized until 2007, they were under federal jurisdiction previously to that, saying that members of their tribe in the past were, I will say, forced to go to Indian schools in Pennsylvania. And they also go all the way back to a court ruling in 1763 in which under the blessings of King George, the Mashpee area was determined to be their lands. And Richard Bourne had originally deeded the property to the Wampanoags. There were people who were non-Indians who were kind of trying to settle in that area. And this court case set aside this land, and the Wampanoags are saying this constitutes a treaty. So they're saying that the comments by Hillary Tompkins, this is Cedric Cromwell, the head of the tribal council, said that the comments by Hillary Tompkins kind of align with what they had in their petition. So although there has been no decision yet about their land into trust application, they're seeing this as a positive sign that they probably will get an affirmative ruling on that.
It's been years since they've applied to put this land into trust, and leaving a lot of people wondering, is that going to happen? What is holding it up? So I think, yeah, I would imagine they are pretty happy to hear this, and the timing of it might fit with what they're trying to do with the casino.
Right, because they had expected to have a determination last year about this, you know, by this time last year.
Sure.
And because they didn't get that, and because they had some, you know, their compact agreement with the state, the first one was denied by the BIA, and now they had to go through it again. The State Gaming Commission allowed commercial organizations or operations to apply for licenses in this Region C, which is where the Wampanoags want to build their casino. And now on that front, Casey Urban, who wants to build a casino in New Bedford, has asked for an extension for their – they were supposed to have their paperwork in for phase two, and they're asking for an extension until October because people who – like the mayor of New Bedford, different investors are saying, wait a minute – if the Wampanoags get their casino, maybe having a casino here isn't all that attractive. And it goes to the fact that the Wampanoags have to pay, their casino would have to pay the state 17% of their gross revenue in taxes to the state. And all the commercial casinos are going to have to pay 25% under the state law. So if you're building a commercial casino where there's an Indian casino and you're having to pay significantly more taxes, that puts you at a disadvantage.
Sure.
The commission yesterday said that they needed to do some more homework, and they'll make a decision on that extension next week.
And there's a trial going on Cape Cod right now regarding John Rams Jr. It's a case we've been following for years on the Cape. So tell us about that briefly. We don't need to get into all the details, but I'm interested a little bit in some of what's happening with the judge in that case. Lots of trouble in paneling a jury in that case.
Right. This is John Rams, who is accused of killing and shooting Shirley Rainey 9 years ago in her garage in Mashpee. And it's a very high-profile case. She was married to Melvin Rainey, who was, a well-known person who had a lot of convictions for arson and other things. And the case has been in our papers and other media, so it's been really difficult. It took, I think, 3 days and more than they had to go through about three jury pools to come up with a jury that didn't know that much about this case. And then on Wednesday, the judge in the case called in sick. Apparently, Judge Gary Nickerson, Barnstable Superior Court, is quite ill. He has a cold and laryngitis, but he's so ill he couldn't get out of bed. So the case is now going to be heard by Judge Robert Rufo, who is having to do a lot of catch-up. There's motions to suppress John Ram's statements.
Yes.
In addition, the judge is saying that I haven't read the grand jury notes. There's like a 14-inch thick file he's got to go through. So the jury has the day off today and while he catches up.
It's going to be quite a case. Could be weeks on end. And I think they expect that people testifying as witnesses will be sequestered, which will be quite a burden. I've seen this the defense attorney before when he was an assistant district attorney, when he was involved in cases up in the Boston area, and he was a tremendous attorney. So it'll be interesting to see how that progresses, and we'll read about that in the Cape Cod Times. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood is going to join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and we can talk about what's happening with the Chatham's Bars Inn and the Fish Pier. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. So Chatham plans to take an easement in the contentious Chatham Bars Inn-owned land fight about the Fish Pier. Give us the background and what's happening there.
Well, this is a roughly 10,000 square foot area on the lower level of the parking lot at the Fish Pier. It's used exclusively for parking for commercial fishermen. For decades, the town and the inn have had an informal agreement allowing fishermen to park in that area and allowing the town to use the land. A few years ago, CBI began using that land as a kind of leverage to gain some concessions from the town. Particularly, they were given some exclusive use of parking spaces in the Piers upper lot, which are pretty valuable in the summer. It's always full there. And in the past year, CBI has become kind of more protective about that beachfront area. And just a few weeks ago, they ordered fishermen to remove skiffs from the beach next to the parking lot. They put up a fence between the parking lot and the beach and put up a no trespassing sign, which you can imagine went over really big with fishermen here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And they also padlocked the gate on that fence. And now selectmen are proposing to take a permanent easement in the 10,000, it's actually 10,566 square feet, and that will give the town exclusive use of that land. It will remain under the ownership of CBI, which the town contends will not harm CBI in any way. They'll still be able to use that land as part of the parcels that contain upon their cottages, so you know they're not really losing any square footage or anything like that. So far, there's been no monetary amount attached to that easement proposal, although a few years ago, the town offered CBI $250,000 for a permanent easement on that property, and the Inn rejected that offer. Town officials say they're still negotiating, and they'll be announcing a monetary amount closer to town meeting.
So this would have to go to town meeting?
Yes, indeed. It would require, I think it would require a majority vote at town meeting. I'm not sure. It may require a two-thirds vote. Basically, the town would be empowered to either continue negotiating to reach a amicable settlement with the Inn, or if that doesn't happen, the article gives the selectmen the power to take that easement by eminent domain.
Mm-hmm. I understand another article at town meeting involves the accepting the FEMA flood maps, which have been so controversial.
Yes, indeed. Actually, there's, at this point, I think three articles related to the FEMA flood maps that will be on the May 12th annual town meeting warrant in Chatham. One is from the planning board, which seeks to incorporate the new maps into the zoning bylaw, which is something that is required for the town to continue to participate in the FEMA flood program. The planning board is also proposing, as part of that, though, to cut back on the area of the conservancy district, which includes the flood map boundaries, and 100 feet from those boundaries. That's the area that's under the jurisdiction of the Conservation Commission. The Planning Board article proposes to keep that at current levels and not expand it. Under the current maps, it expands quite a bit. A lot of people are concerned that areas that have no relation to wetlands or would be actually ever prone to flooding could come under jurisdiction of the Conservation Commission under that eventuality. There's also a group of residents in town who call themselves the Flood Zone Relief Committee who submitted a petition article which would remove that 100-foot buffer area from jurisdiction of the Conservation Commission regarding any sort of coastal flooding provisions. And there's still another petition article from some conservation advocates that would make the new floodplain boundaries incorporate the new floodplain boundaries into that 100-foot buffer zone. So it's all kind of confusing in a way, and it's going to be we really have our job cut out for us here at the paper to try to explain the intricacies of all these different articles and provisions to the voters in the next few weeks.
Or else you're going to have a very long town meeting come May.
That may happen anyway. We've actually got about 10 or 12 petition articles this year at Chatham Town Meeting, which is quite unusual.
What's surrounding the $6 million water treatment facility in the petition, in the article there?
That's the state hasn't required towns to put in treatment facilities yet for iron and manganese, but they're trending towards that. A couple wells in Chatham regularly exceed the recommended levels, maximums of iron and manganese in the water, and the town officials are saying they need to build a treatment facility to lower those levels to remove most of the iron and manganese. Harwich has done that actually for wells that are just over the town border from these two particular wells in Chatham. Harwich built one plant a couple years ago. They're actually in the process of building a second treatment plant for the same thing. Town officials say they've explored whether it would make more sense to tie into the Harwich plant, and they said that that would not make economic sense. It would actually cost more to pipe the water to Harwich and then pipe it back to Chatham than to build a treatment plant right in Chatham. So voters are going to be asked to shell out $6 million for that in May as well.
And I'd like to, if you have it, I'd love to hear an update on what's happening with the wetland restoration. I think it was Super Bowl Sunday when a resident decided to go out and take a bobcat or a skid steer for a little drive right. to fix some wetlands, and it didn't work out so well.
Yeah, not for him, that's for sure.
No.
This is on Sears Point in Stage Harbor. The Conservation Commission came down pretty hard on the property owner. His name is David Rogers. They issued 13 violations daily up until last Wednesday, where they decided to stop issuing the tickets. The tickets totaled, I think, about $129,000. Mr. Rogers appealed those tickets. There was supposed to be a hearing on that today. He's out of the country, so the hearing was postponed until next week. He has, in the meantime, submitted a restoration plan to restore about 4,000 square feet of marsh, coastal salt marsh. And the Conservation Commission has accepted that plan tentatively. They want some more detail on it. But they've decided to that this will it won't restore completely the damage, because you know salt marsh takes decades to build up, and you're never going to recreate exactly what was there. But they've the plan, they say, will put back some of what was there. Mr. Rogers also agreed to restore some shellfish because. As part of this process, he took the machine out onto the flats beyond the high tide mark and actually sort of graded the flats and allegedly removed quite a bit of shellfish from that area. So he's going to put back some of those shellfish, which again, you know, is it ever going to be back the way it was naturally? It could take years. We don't know, but this is about the best we can expect, the Conservation Commission says right now.
Okay. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and you can follow the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Appreciate it, Tim. Thank you.
No problem, Sean. Thanks a lot.
Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And joining us on the phone is Joshua Balling. He's the assistant editor at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Tell us about the housing crunch on Nantucket.
Well, Nantucket has traditionally had a housing crunch, usually for seasonal residents, over the last couple of decades as it's gained in popularity as a vacation destination, second home destination. But this year in particular, over the last couple of years even, the year-round housing situation is getting tighter and tighter. And that's quite a concern for those of us who live here year-round, employers as well, who are looking to attract and retain qualified employees both for their seasonal and their year-round businesses. We're hearing from a lot of people. We've got a story in this week's paper sort of detailing what's going on with the year-rounders. Many of them who have been in long-term rentals or year-round rentals, those houses are being sold. They're being sold to vacationers. They're being sold for other purposes, and they're out of a home and looking for a place, and there really just aren't that many out there. Anecdotal evidence is all over the place. You see signs posted in windows and on bulletin boards looking for not just seasonal housing, as seems to happen every year, but year-round housing. You go on the Inquirer and Mirror's classified pages, both online and the paper and some of the other classified websites, and there's just nothing out there. Yesterday, there were 35 people posting classified ads looking for seasonal and year-round housing, and 5 seasonal rentals listed, no year-rounders. You talk to some real estate agents, they say there's probably a number of reasons for this. The strengthening economy, which is bringing some more people to Nantucket in search of jobs, employers looking to ramp up some of their hiring for both seasonal and year-round employers has something to do with it. But simple supply and demand also, I think, has something to do with it. A number of the houses that for years had been used as rentals in some neighborhoods that weren't necessarily desirable to vacationers in the middle of the island, other places that weren't convenient to town or convenient to the beaches, are turning into vacation neighborhoods. These homes are being sold, and the rentals are being discontinued, and people are moving into them or using them as vacation homes or renting them as vacation destinations. And people who live here year-round or need even seasonal housing for the whole season are out of luck.
Yeah, certainly a very important issue. What else are you working on in the paper this week, Josh?
I've got a number of different things going on. The Board of Selectmen on Wednesday night approved a couple of new restaurant licenses. It's always big news out here, and we have new restaurants on the island. Nantucket, obviously a culinary destination as well as a vacation destination. We have some of the best restaurants in the world. Two new restaurants coming, both ends of the spectrum, really. One, Children's Beach. There's the Beach Shack there. Bart Gangemi from Easy Street Cantina will be opening up there and serving all kinds of beach food and fresh fried seafood, sandwiches, hamburgers, hot dogs, that kind of thing to people hanging out at Children's Beach. The Nantucket Prime is coming into the Jared Coffin House. That's the right downtown. It's a place that didn't have a restaurant last year, and that looks to be opened by the Nantucket Wine Festival, serving both the guests there and Nantucket visitors and residents alike. So we're looking forward to another good restaurant season on the island and a pretty busy summer, if only they can find a place to live.
That's right. All right. Joshua Ballings, the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and director of the digital content at the paper. You can follow Josh on Twitter at JBallingIM. Appreciate your time, Josh. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. And Ann, I wanted to talk about a story in the paper regarding electronic voting at town meeting. We have, you know, town meeting has persisted here in Massachusetts and in the United States for hundreds of years. And now there's an effort to bring in a little electric doodads to make things go a little bit more smoothly.
Right. Eastham actually is the first town on the Cape to discuss or try to is going to make a decision whether they're going to go to electronic voting. This is a TV remote control type device that you would record your vote with. And the reason why Eastham is looking at this is because it would eliminate the hand counting, which can often take time, and it would also allow neighbors to have some privacy with their vote, and as well as just save some time. So the Eastham is going to be considering this on May 5th, but it doesn't at their town meeting May 5th, but it doesn't come without a cost.
That's right. I mean, I was reading the story. I'm like, this makes perfect sense. And then you hit the cost.
Right.
And it's significant.
Well, they've already a special town meeting already approved $34,500 to rent the equipment. It doesn't make sense to buy the equipment, because if you rent it, somebody comes and sets it up. If there's a problem, they can take care of it. There's a lot of support. So they're looking at the rental model. And other town meetings have started using these devices, and it costs anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 a meeting, depending on how many people attend the meeting.
I know you don't have to offer an opinion, but I can't imagine spending $50,000 for a town meeting that in the past maybe you had to pay for some employees of the town to be there and a police detail. And now thousands upon thousands to speed things up, I think is what it boils down to.
Well, at the $50,000 end, it would be a meeting with 2,000 people.
Okay,
so if you have a hand vote of, you know, that you have to count 2,000 people, that does take significant time. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're looking at salaries and other things, it might make sense. Mm-hmm. But in Eastham, they're looking at also this privacy issue. And when, you know, your neighbor can, you might not want to vote the way they are, and you might feel a little pressured. This way you have some privacy. And the other thing is that the thought went right out of my mind.
No, I think you make a good point, because I'm sure that does influence people when they go to town meeting. What are my neighbors going to think? But that may as well be part of the system that is kind of developed here over hundreds of years.
Well, and the other thing is that voice votes.
Yes.
Is not necessarily the majority of people are the loudest. It's the loudest people who are the loudest. And that's another thing that they're talking about, that if we have this system, it does away with the voice voting. But that's a little sad, because like you said, the first town meeting in the state of Massachusetts was in Dorchester in 1633, and it's continued through to today. It's unique to New England, as far as I know. We'll see what happens.
We'll
so
see
May
what happens.
5th, they'll
Could
make
be
a decision.
Trend. As you said, some other communities in the state have already decided that they want to rent for individual meetings, and we'll watch that. Let's talk. There's been a lot of discussion about some solar projects that the concern was here on the Cape and the Islands that they would be put aside because of a contracting business going out of business, and now it seems like some of those projects might actually happen.
Right. About 13 megawatts of projects, solar projects in 9 Cape towns will actually be transferred from the company, Broadway Electrical Company, that announced it was going out of business in January, to a new company. This is good news because it moves this forward. One of the things that people feared when this happened was whether these projects could move forward because they had to have them in place in June, the 1st of June, in order to get these certificates. The certificates are important because their utilities have to have a certain percentage of alternative energy in their power mix, and utilities that don't have that mix can then buy these certificates, and that's what underwrites building these projects. So that extension, that the state has extended that for a month with an open door of maybe a further extension if they can't get these solar arrays up as quickly as they want to, but it looks like it's going to be going forward.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Ann Brennan will still be here in our Woods Hole studio, but we'll be joined by Nelson Siegelman on the phone. He's the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman. He's the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, a few weeks ago, we were talking about the V&A and a takeover that was happening there, but things have collapsed, I guess. Explain that to us, if you would.
Well, I will try and explain it, but I have to tell you, I spent a couple of days trying to understand it myself, and healthcare issues are never easy, and this one still leaves a few questions to be asked. In January, we reported that the Visiting Nurse Association of Cape Cod was going to take over the assets and liabilities of the Martha's Vineyard Visiting Nurse Association. That was a pretty good deal for the island V&A because it meant that they could basically walk away from a building that they had invested more than $1.5 million in, and that's what they owed, and they had a number of bills, and all seemed to be going forward, and the V&A of Cape Cod is certainly has a good reputation. It's a very large organization. Then last week, we heard that the V&A had closed its doors and many of the employees had moved over to the Cape V&A, but the press release, unlike the first one, was a bit more oblique, and it didn't really describe the fact that, in fact, it wasn't a takeover, just the Cape V&A waited while the Vineyard V&A closed its doors and then took over the patient load and the employees. So in trying to get to the bottom of it, the Cape V&A said basically they did their due diligence and decided not to go forward with a letter of intent, and they cited both state and federal regulatory agencies. The Island V&A said that the Cape Group just decided they didn't need the building. But getting more details on that was a bit difficult. In the meantime, both the Martha's Vineyard Hospital and the Martha's Vineyard Community Services had both talked about doing some sort of deal with the Island V&A, but in the end, those didn't work out. The bottom line, though, I should mention, is that all of the people that were cared for are still being cared for, and that everyone that I spoke with said that ultimately was the most important thing.
Of course, yeah, that was going to be my question, that those services are continuing. Let's move on to the New West Tisbury Library, which opens. That was a reconstruction of the previous building?
Yeah,
is that what it was?
It was an expansion. Basically, the library that was built in 1993 and was about 5,600 square feet is now a newly renovated 13,000 square foot library, and with a number of new architectural additions and more space, more room, more high tech gizmos, lots of shelf space, meeting room. Vineyard is very generous when they come to their libraries. This is, you know, just the latest in a either new or newly renovated library. Edgartown has embarked on a project to build a new library. So, you know, at a time when people think maybe that old-fashioned book and library is disappearing, that's not really the case, because these buildings are becoming something of community centers as well.
Yes, so much more goes on at the libraries than ever before, and I've been to that West Tisbury Library. Very nice.
Yes, they're going to have a grand opening Saturday morning, so certainly everyone's invited. You don't have to be from West Tisbury to go and see the nice job that they've done.
Oh, great. And Ann Brennan and I were talking about this earlier, that the presidential family is returning to Martha's Vineyard. What do you get on the ground there? What's the sense? People happy about this? People shrugging their shoulders? What do you hear?
Well, you know, I don't want to sound like this is old hat, but in some ways, you know, this is, I guess, the fourth year, and every year about this time we start to hear the same rumors that preparations are being made, reservations are being made, and that's the case. You know, if you're going to come here in August, whether you're a president or just Joe Schmo from East Oshkosh, you've got to make your reservations early. So that's what's happening now. We know that world events could upend the president's vacation plans, but right now we heard from fairly reputable sources that there have been a number of reservations made from the White House support staff, and that's really what's happened so far. What ends up happening in August, we still, you know, have to see.
Okay. Nelson Sigelman is the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. You can hear more about these stories and others by visiting the Martha's Vineyard Times website. Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
Ann Brennan is with me in our Woods Hole studio. There's a bit of a big push at the State House, Ann, regarding the minimum wage increase, and Senator Wolf for this region has been right at the front of that.
Has been championing a bill in the Senate that actually passed that would raise the minimum wage to $11 an hour by 2016, and workers who rely on tips would get half the minimum wage. That would be their salary. And the fly in the ointment for other members of the Cape Cod legislative delegation is that future increases would be tied to the Consumer Price Index rather than an act of the legislature. Earlier this week, Speaker Robert DeLeo laid out his plan for minimum wage, which would increase the wage from $8 to $9 this year, $10 next year, and $10.50 in 2016. For tipped employees, it would raise it from $2.63 an hour to $3.75 an hour by 2016. But there is no tie to Consumer Price Index. Mm. And it seems that the rest of the Cape legislative delegation doesn't like giving away their power to a Consumer Price Index that, you know,
they'd like to come back in a few years if they want it raised. They would want to raise it themselves rather than have it happen automatically.
Right. Because I think businesses want to know what's going to happen. And a consumer price index would not allow them to plan as well. But Wolf is saying, you know, 45 years ago, the minimum wage in today's dollars would have been about $10.72. It's taking, the legislature is not keeping the minimum wage up with today's values, the Consumer Price Index would. But I heard at the top of the hour here that apparently the House bill was filed a day late, so it's not clear whether it's going to be able to go forward. I was just going off what was said at the top of the hour,
yes.
So I guess it's up in the air at this point.
Sounds like some heavy politics going on around this issue.
And I just want to add, too, that there is a ballot initiative now where they want to raise the minimum wage to $10.50 by 2016, but also tie future increases to inflation. So if this ballot initiative wins in the state, then it could be a moot point in
the
end.
Trump the legislature. Sally Rose is joining us now. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for joining us. Talk about this open meeting law complaint filed against the Provincetown Finance Committee.
Well, yes, it was filed by a local resident who also happens to be the town's health and environmental affairs agent. He told us, however, that he filed the complaint as an individual and not as a town employee. It was filed on March 12th, and it says that he observed five members of Provincetown's Finance Committee in a local pizza restaurant in mid-February, and they were discussing items related to the town's budget. On top of that, there was a budget binder open and out on the table. So in addition to the five members of FinCom, also with him was the town moderator, who is married to one of the FinCom members and is also, of course, that board's appointing authority. The chair of the FinCom, Mike Canizales, said earlier this week that the issue of what he referred to as, quote, spontaneous social gatherings has come up before, and that both town council and the attorney general's office have determined that they do not constitute violations. So both the chair and the town moderator expressed indignation at this complaint. At this point, the finance committee has, from the time of the complaint, has 14 days to respond to it and then send a copy of it along with a description of any action it took to the attorney general's office. As of our deadline this week, the local resident who filed it, Brian Carlson, he said he has not yet received the finance committee's response, which he says when he does get, he will study it before deciding whether he wants to then file the complaint with the attorney general's office.
So, Sally, is anyone who was at that meeting, I guess we could call it, what they might call a social gathering, said that this didn't happen? Anyone denying the facts as you presented them?
Not that we have spoken with.
I see.
And the complainant also says that there were other people there who did witness it.
And do you know what type of training officials receive? Yes. Any idea?
Well, I think they have all taken classes on the open meeting law. I think there's several coming up scheduled by the Attorney General's office, by the state. And interestingly, we're also running with this story this week. We've run a companion piece that by one of our sister publications that talks about how the state's open meeting law essentially lacks teeth,
right?
As it's enforced now, so it'll be interesting to follow this.
Absolutely, it will. And this is a persistent problem in communities where it's almost like, how can we get around the open meeting law rather than abide by it? It's hard to understand. I don't know. I guess maybe it saves times at meetings if you meet in advance, but that's really not how it's supposed to work. And I know as a reporter on the ground, nothing drives you, you know, more crazy than when you should have access to the conversation and the deliberations and you're denied.
Right.
And then when you go to the state, they're just told, well, don't do it again, because there are no teeth. There is no teeth in these laws. Same thing when you're asking for public documents, which seem to be getting more difficult to obtain here on Cape Cod. Okay, that's my soapbox. Sally Rose, thank you so much. Sally's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. You can read more about this story and others in the Provincetown Banner this week. Thanks, Sally.
Thanks, Sean.
And right here in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times. And let's talk. There was a story this week about the Cape Cod's homeless, and one of the reporters headed up to Salem, Massachusetts, on the North Shore of Boston, to look at how they're dealing with the homelessness situation, which is significant in that city. And it seems to people are looking at their model and saying, hey, maybe we can do that here.
Right. I think the big difference in Salem is that they have a day program for people who are homeless, places they can come, get out of the cold. But also there's ties to Salem State University. People could take courses. And that way they're trying to transition. The whole idea behind this day program is to provide services and transition people into transitional housing and ultimately out of homelessness to their own self-sustaining life. So that's the big push on that agency.
So you say that we don't have a day program here.
No.
So essentially, you can stay overnight in the shelter
right.
That's in Hyannis, but then you got to get out. in the morning, and you can't just hang around all day.
Right. There are some, you know, coffee houses, like mm-hmm. coffee places, a couple of places around town, like at the Federated Church, where people can come in for a few hours. But there's no programs associated with those. Where in Salem, the police are on board. And in fact, the police are got a grant up in Salem so that in their patrols, there's three officers that are assigned to this. They'll have somebody who can provide services or figure out what services this homeless person needs to help them get out of homelessness, whether it be mental illness, drug abuse, or just somebody down on their luck who lost everything and are struggling to get back to where they were. And because of that, the community, there is a little bit of a, you know, tension with the community living around this center in Salem called LifeBridge, but it has helped the homeless problem and negative interactions, as well as instead of just saying we have homeless people, we're going to give them a place to sleep. These are people who are now saying this is not going to go away unless we do something about it. So Elizabeth Wurfbane and mm-hmm. Police Chief Paul McDonald went up and looked at Salem's model. There and other people now have gone up to look at it. It's going to take an outlay of cash. That program costs about $1.2 million a year. So there are some money issues that have to be taken care of, but that's what they're looking at.
Okay, a story this week about a new way to use the library, and this one involves seeds.
Right. This is a like you say, a new way to use a library. Cape Cod Food Hub is creating partnerships with local libraries to have seeds, packs of seeds, packages of seeds that people can come and take. And then when they finish next, you know, at the end of the summer, they would bring some of those seeds back and replace them. This is one way to keep heritage seeds continuing, preserve heritage seeds, but also to just allow people access to seeds and become more aware of where food comes from. And you know,
is it the Brooks Library that's doing it?
It is the yes.
Yeah. And that could spread to other libraries.
Well, Truro has one as well. They're hoping to spread that out to other libraries across the Cape. And, you know, it's a great idea. They also, at the Brooks Library, they have purchase some books so people can read books about how to grow certain things. And
there was a story this week as well about a World War II veteran, a very nice story, who is finally being honored for his service.
Right. Kiyoshi Ita, 91, who lives in Hyannis at a nursing home there, was part of the 4th 42nd Regimental Combat Team in Europe. That was an all-Japanese-American unit that later merged with another unit. But they were the most decorated unit in the World War II. And because of that, back in 2008, President Obama decided to, 2010, signed a bill that would give everyone in that regiment a Congressional Gold Medal, which is one of the highest civilian honors anyone can receive. But when the paperwork came out, Kiyoshi Ota's niece didn't find his name. Her uncle's name was on the list of people, but he wasn't. So Ota's golfing buddy, a man who was a Vietnam veteran, helped her get the paperwork together, and the gold medal was given to him last Sunday.
It's a very nice story. For me, it was really sad. I do a lot of reporting around Alzheimer's disease. It was really sad to read at the end of the story that by this point in his life, he has dementia.
Right.
But when his niece told him about this medal, he understood what she said, and he's quoted as saying, well, it's about time.
Right. And, you know, in the context of the time, I was thinking, wow, how did he not get interned? And he was living in Ogden, Utah when the war broke out. And I don't think a lot of people know that there was a Japanese-American unit fighting in Europe. And mm-hmm. That was one thing that touched me about this story, was a little bit of our history.
Yeah. I want to thank Ann Brennan for coming in. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thanks, Ann.
Thank you.
And you can follow Ann on Twitter at Anne Brennan, CCT. And thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.